sometime soon, I hope to complete that little saga that I was talking about last Sunday, that's represented by the first letter of John, how the Johannine community basically exploded. Self-destructive, I suppose you would say today. But today, in Canada, we're celebrating yet another stage in the drama of the career of Jesus. And I just want to point out that all of these events are connected, at least scripturally. Jesus' life, Jesus' death, Jesus being raised by God, Jesus going to the Father, and the sending of the Spirit. This is a continuum. It's a history, if you will. The Jews, when they believed that God was going to raise the just from the dead, believed that that was going to be the end event, the end time, the so-called eschatological event. So that when they came to believe that God had raised Jesus from the dead, this meant several things, as I've said. This meant that God validated the humanity of this man. That is, this is the way to be a human being. But it also meant that the end of the world as we know it was going to occur. So Paul, for example, to the day he died, probably in 68, believed that God was going to send Jesus back to judge because it was all over. And the ascension, what we call the ascension, fits very nicely into that because the whole point of human life is to be brought back to God. And the Jews, who had no idea of souls, but only knew people who were humans, were embodied beings. Therefore, they had to talk about Jesus bodily being brought back to God. The completion of the human of the human story. In the case of Jesus. But then in the case of the rest of us, of course, part of the rest of the Jewish belief was that once the end time would come, God is going to send forth her spirit over everything. You may remember that at the beginning of Acts, huh? In those days I will pour out my spirit on all flesh. What does that mean? Well, the Jews have been talking about the Spirit of God for centuries, millennia probably. What is the Spirit of God? The Spirit of God is a way of talking about God as enlivening us. Spirit simply means breath. So you have the Spirit, you have breath, but it's clearly not just a biological phenomenon we're talking about. Because to be alive is, at least in the biblical understanding, is not just a biological or a physiological phenomenon. It's a human phenomenon. And to be alive means to be alive as Jesus was alive. So after Jesus is with the Father, then this great outpouring, this eschatological outpouring of the Spirit on all flesh is to occur. And that's what's celebrated as the continuation, if you will, of ascension. And so, as I said, since I'm not going to be here for Mass, I don't think it's fudging too much to elide the ascension and Pentecost, because they are part of the same continuum. So we need to talk about this Spirit business. The Spirit, again, is the Jews' way of talking about animating us, vitalizing us, energizing us, enlivening us, making us really human beings. So that, you recall in the Acts narrative about the first Pentecost, what was the first manifestation of that, that total strangers could understand each other? Total strangers could speak to each other, could understand each other. Why? Because this is some magical thing, you know, glossolalia, that kind of nonsense. No, it means that the human community is being brought into being, because you only have a community when people listen to each other and can speak freely to each other. You don't have a community otherwise. And that's exactly what Luke was very consciously pointing to when he said all these strangers could now all of a sudden connect with each other. Because that's what the Spirit of God is all about. Okay? But the Spirit of God does not work in some kind of, according to the biblical witness, does not work in some kind of magical way where you go from black to white, which is, again, one of the problems of the Johannine community. No, it is a gradual process. So to go back to Luke, too, who spends more time talking about this than anybody else, Luke makes a very close connection between receiving the Spirit of God and therefore being able to witness to God. That is, if you are transformed, if you are enlivened by the Spirit of God, then you bespeak the reality of God by who you are. Witnessing, in that great line from Cardinal Suard of Paris, the great archbishop during the Second World War, said, to be a witness does not consist in multiplying words, engaging in propaganda. To be a witness is not an exercise in public relations, in other words. To be a witness means to live in such a way that one's life does not make sense if God did not exist. That's what it is to be a witness. To live in such a way that one's life made no sense if God did not exist. In other words, because you are the enlivening power of God in a world which often enough resists that, marked by fear, distrust, suspicion, hatred, violence, to act in a different way is to testify to the reality of God in a world which is not particularly receptive to that. And again, let me pause just a minute. When we talk about the Spirit, because we have the phenomenon of the charismatics and people being slain in the Spirit and people speaking in tongues and all this other business, yeah, well, I don't know what to do with that, frankly. But clearly, Paul had that problem too, if you remember, in 1 Corinthians, where he said, even if I spoke with the tongues of men and angels, but did not have love, it's useless, it's a bloody waste of time. Because Paul is a good Jew, knew what the Spirit was to do to people. So somehow, there is some kind of sense of transformative power, some vision, that now becomes part of who I am. I see the world differently. I see myself differently. I see parts of myself as resisting God. I see for the first time my life lived under the sign of fear, for example, which I would not have seen had I not had the Spirit of God. And then move to some kind of courage in a world where such courage is either foolhardy or dangerous or bold. To live in this way. To take everybody seriously in that great line from Karl Rahner. Remember? Every year I think I quote that. Somebody asked Karl Rahner, the great, maybe the greatest theologian of the 20th century, said, well, how do you know people have the Spirit? He says, when somebody takes somebody else seriously as a human being, that's where the Spirit of God is. So it's not all this rum-tum. This extravagant, these extravagant phenomena, you know. It's not bells and whistles religiosity. It's not blitz religiosity. It's basic transformation, where people can say the truth to each other, or hear the truth from each other, or be aware that they're doing neither. So, if we were to ask, for example, where is the Spirit in the church today? In the world today? I think that's a really useful question. especially in a church where we have bishop after bishop dissimulating, hiding, concealing, temporizing in regard to sexual abuses. Where we have authority often enough exercised as an instrument of force rather than of growth. To the extent that we embody that, we are dispirited. We are spiritless. And I said for all these years, if this stuff does not somehow impinge on our real lives, and if we don't impinge on the real world, then we're all just whistling past the graveyard, folks. We're just wasting our time. Play religion, as a friend of mine used to say. We're playing church. So there is one function of the Spirit, I think, that is particularly needful today. And taking this again from the Hebrew Scriptures, where was the great manifestation of the Spirit in the Hebrew Scriptures? Well, we get it in Genesis, where God breathes, inspires his little play dummy, who gets up and turns out to be a human being. That's the Spirit. But more consistently, we have the Spirit operating in the careers of the prophets. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me. You have Isaiah, Jeremiah, Daniel, Ezekiel, always prefacing what they have to say with that self-description. They believed that they were doing what? Seeing the world as God saw it. Because that's what it is to be a human being. And that's why they all got killed, of course, including Jesus. Because we want business as usual. Fear pays, after all. So what did the prophets do? They simply told the truth. That's all. That's all. The prophet just told the truth. Why do I say that's important? I don't know whether Vernon, I don't think he forwarded a couple of pieces from the New York Times. It's a very interesting. You know, the weapons of mass destruction was just the conviction that they were there and they were going to destroy the U.S. was the major basis for the war in Iraq. They haven't found any. But there are a whole bunch of people in the CIA who've written to Bush saying, you have cooked the data, folks. You have used this in a purely strategic way to mount the war that you wanted. What am I getting at? That's a lie, folks. That's a lie. We as Christians cannot be party to that lie. Although if you read the great conservative spokespeople from the Roman Church, Michael Novak goes to Rome to lecture the cardinals that the war ought to be waged. George Weigel says, well, the Pope doesn't know anything. This is the guy who's written the biography of John Paul II who canonized him, and yet George Weigel said, well, the Pope may know something, but he doesn't know diddly about real politics. Richard Neuhaus, the kind of house chaplain to the Vatican. Now, the most conservative voices in the church say, oh, this war is really a groovy idea. Well, where is the voice of prophecy? Where is the voice of prophecy today? Where do we hear the inspired speech? Speech that comes out of a mouth moved by the enlivening power of God. I find it fairly depressing that if I try to sit down and list these people, it's Ralph Nader, comes to mind. Noam Chomsky comes to mind. As people who simply want to tell the truth. In a world that is not especially receptive to that. The church, therefore, if it is to be the church of Jesus Christ, must speak with a prophetic voice. Or it should shut up. It has nothing useful to say to anybody. And this goes not just for bishops and cardinals and popes, but for us as well.